When a rabbi travels to foreign lands, he naturally wants to meet Jews, to learn something of their way of life, their community organizations, to see their synagogues, the schools, and generally to become acquainted with their status in the countries where they live. The Jewish communities which we visited were aware of our coming and were very warm in their welcome and in their hospitality. In fact, the real problem soon presented itself to us. Our trip was in danger of becoming a sort of a series of meetings and receptions and lectures and and I would be enjoying what is technically known as a busman's holiday. But we succeeded in striking a happy medium. There are not many Jews in the countries which we visited. There are not many Jews in Asia. Historically speaking, there were never many Jews in Asia beyond, say, the Babylon or Mesopotamia or Persia, now Iran. The far countries, India and China and the Orient, did not attract many Jews. The trend of Jewish immigration was, generally speaking, westward to Europe and to Northern Africa. Although from the important Jewish centers of Babylon and Mesopotamia, some Jews did migrate eastward, but they never established any important Jewish communities in that part of the world. And there were never centers, creative centers of Jewish life or of Jewish culture. During the two world wars, there was a large aggregate or collection of Jews in Shanghai. In 1941, there were actually about 25, 30,000 Jews in Shanghai. But they were mostly refugees, Russian Jews who had come to China and then to Shanghai, who fled from the Russian Revolution, and later on, Austrian and German Jews who fled from the Nazis. Most of these Jews were largely dependent upon relief, principally from the United States. And when the Japanese invaded China, and later on when the communist revolution took place in China, this community was completely scattered. Jews left for Australia, for Palestine, for Canada, for the United States, for Mexico. There are probably today less than 500 Jews in the whole of China. Before we flew to India, we spent a little over a week in Greece. There are today some 6,000 or 7,000 Jews in the whole of Greece, 3,000 of them in Athens, its capital. Before the Second World War, in the one Greek city of Salonika, there were over 50,000 Jews. The leaders of the Jewish community of Athens called upon us to pay their respects, invited us to visit their small synagogue and school, which we, of course, did. And then the representatives of the Jewish Agency in Athens invited us to come and see Romanian immigrants who were coming in large numbers to Athens on their way to Israel. Romania had finally consented to allow some of its Jews to leave the country and to join their relatives in Israel. And from Athens, these Romanian immigrants were being airlifted 100 or 200 a day by El Al to Lida in Israel. We met a contingent of these immigrants in the hotel which is being temporarily placed at their disposal by the Jewish Agency. I spoke to them. I listened to their story. There is a lot of pioneers and immigrants that any country, and especially Israel, would want. Mostly younger people, energetic, trained, some of them expert mechanics, technicians, professional people, artisans generally. A good lot of people. They told me of their hardships in Romania in trying to obtain an exit permit. Some of them had to wait 4 or 5 years before they obtained this permit, and they lost their jobs from the very moment that they applied for the exit permit. When they were finally permitted to leave, they were allowed only the barest minimum of possessions to take along with them. And at the border, they were closely searched and examined. Every piece of fruit that they had, an apple or an orange, was cut open to see whether they were hiding any jewelry in. Soles of their shoes were torn loose, pried loose to see whether they were hiding anything in it. They had not a shred over and above the minimum which was permitted them to take out. But they did not seem to mind it at all when I met them in Athens. They were on their way to freedom and a new life. And their hearts were uplifted and full of hope, although they knew that a rugged pioneering life and not a life of comfort and luxuries was awaiting them in Israel. Thousands of these Romanian immigrants will be coming and are coming today to Israel in the next few months. In Athens, we were also entertained by American embassy officials, keen, intelligent, alert people, who gave us a general picture of what the United States government was trying to do in Greece in order to help that country solve its grave economic problems. From Greece, we flew to Bombay, India. In relation to India's population of approximately 380 million, the number of Jews in India, about 20 to 25,000, is almost negligible. Bombay is the largest Jewish center in India, has about 15,000 Jews. Most of them in very modest circumstances, many of them quite poor. That is true, of course, of the entire population, of most of the entire population of India. The Jewish community of Bombay is made up of two groups, Baghdadi Jews, that are Jews who had come from Iraq, from Baghdad, and the Bnei Israel. The Baghdad Jews, who had settled in Bombay some of them 150 years ago, 175 years ago, had for their leaders and patrons the members of the famous Sassoon family, whose members helped them to build and to establish their synagogues and their schools and their charitable institutions and their important endowments. The second group, the majority group, are the Bnei Israel, the older settlers. They are of a darker skin than the Baghdadi Jews, generally speaking. Some say that they came to India some 2,000 years ago. Some maintain that they came there even while the kingdom of Judea was still in existence. Through the centuries, they became pretty well assimilated and their Judaism became quite diluted with Hindu practices and superstitions. But it appears that in the 18th century, a Jew from Cochin, an agent of the Dutch East India Trading Company, visited the Bnei Israel in Bombay and interested himself in their religious life and set about teaching their children, establishing schools for them, the traditions of Judaism, and teaching also the elders Jewish customs and observances, and sort of initiated a revival of Judaism among these Bnei Israel. And a few years ago, the World Union of Progressive Judaism interested itself in these same Bnei Israel in Bombay and fostered a Jewish religious union, a synagogue and a school on the model of our liberal synagogues in the United States. That Jewish religious union has a young American rabbi, a graduate of the Hebrew Union College, as a spiritual leader, a fine man who's doing excellent work among them. And I was privileged to bring to this congregation of the Bnei Israel formed by the World Union a contribution of $10,000 to help them find new quarters for their synagogue and their school. I was, of course, greatly welcomed. I had an opportunity to address them all, and it was a unique experience for me to address those Jews. By the way, nearly all of them speak English, because Bombay, as you know, for 100 years and more, was the great center of the British Empire in India, one of the great centers. In the capital of India, in New Delhi, there is only a very small Jewish community, perhaps of about 150 to 200 souls. Some of them are in government service, and some Indian Jews are very high in the service of the Indian government, in the Army and in the Navy and the Air Force and so forth. They have a small synagogue in New Delhi, to which we were taken. They are loyal Jews who are trying hard to maintain their community life. They have no rabbi. The laymen of the community read the service and try to teach their children. They're hoping now to get themselves a spiritual leader, at least a trained religious teacher. Calcutta, perhaps the most depressing city that we saw in India, a city of about 2 million, had until recently some 2,000 Jews, mostly Baghdadi Jews, a few rich Jews, most of them of the lower middle class, and quite a number of them poor. Half of these 2,000 Jews have already emigrated to Israel. Others are preparing to do so. The community seems to be liquidating. seemingly there are few economic prospects there for them. They've realized it, and most of them, if not all of them, are getting ready to leave. While in New Delhi, the capital of modern India, I was invited to tea with the Vice President of India, Radhakrishnan, in the absence of Prime Minister Nehru from New Delhi. Radhakrishnan, you may recall, is perhaps the outstanding philosopher of India and also one of its leading statesmen. He had been to the United States, lectured here, and he was eager to tell me of the progress which India was making in spite of its many difficult problems, and of his hope for world peace. He was sure that there would be no world war. He stressed India's friendship for the United States and hoped that we would not misinterpret the occasional acts of the Indian government, which seemed to be rather distasteful to us, as the true attitude of the Indian government and the Indian people towards the United States. We discussed India's attitude to Israel, with which India had not yet established formal diplomatic relations, although there is an Israeli consul, a very competent man, Mr. Caspi, in Bombay. He thought that the presence of a very large Muslim population in India was naturally delaying this recognition, this step, which in his judgment was sure to come, as being inevitable. His sympathies were strongly with Israel. I suggested to him larger trade and cultural contacts with Israel. I also suggested that he make a visit as philosopher, teacher, to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem on a lecture visit. He seemed to be very receptive to the idea. An interesting comment which he made to me, which impressed me considerably, at that time, you know, everybody was talking about Boris Pasternak, the author of Dr. Zhivago, and the Nobel Prize which was given to him, which he couldn't accept. Radhakrishnan was rather critical of the whole business and of the Nobel Prize givers. He said, here is an organization or a body which overlooked the great Gandhi, did not give him the Nobel Prize, and overlooked Count Leo Tolstoy, but gave the Nobel Prize to Pasternak, of whose book, Dr. Zhivago, he did not seem to think so much. Well, I thought you'd be interested in this interesting item. We flew from India to Burma, Burma which figured so prominently in the Second World War, where our own men fought in some of the decisive battles, land battles, of the Far East were fought. And in Burma, as you come to Burma, you enter what you might call the Buddhist world. India is overwhelmingly Hindu, although Buddhism originated in India. And we visited outside of Benares, the great stupas, which still stand, which mark the place where Gautama, the enlightened one, Gautama the Buddha, more than 2,500 years ago, preached his first sermons to his first five disciples. India was the home, of course, also of the great emperor Asoka, who did so much to spread the faith of Buddhism and to build Buddhist monasteries all over the empire. But Buddhism, for one reason or another, did not thrive in India. But it spread eastward and took firm hold in the countries of the Far East, countries of Indochina and Indonesia, in China and in Japan. The first thing that strikes you when you come to the capital of Burma, Rangoon, is this great golden steeple of the magnificent Shwe Dagon Pagoda, which rises some 307 feet high on an elevation of more than 170 feet, rises above the level of the city. And this steeple of this towering pagoda is covered with pure gold from base to summit. And once every 40 years, this gold is renewed by public subscription. And everywhere you go in that world of the Far East, you find Buddhist shrines and temples, large and small. In the city of Bangkok alone, there are 2,000 Buddhist temples. Golden Buddha, Emerald Buddha. About 40 miles outside of Rangoon, we visited the city of Pegu, which was the old capital of northern Burma. And there's a reclining Buddha. Oh, I don't know, I've forgotten them. 150 feet long. In Japan, in Kamakura, we saw that huge, a famous huge bronze image of Buddha, 42 feet high, 97 feet around the base, which was cast in the 13th century. And in another Japanese city of Nara, there's an even larger Buddha, 53 feet high, weighing over 500 tons. In Kyoto, which was the Japanese capital before Tokyo became the capital, there's one vast hall where you see 1,000 Buddhas standing, 1,000 images and figures of the Buddha. The Buddhists somehow have a way of showing their adoration not only in their devoutness, but in the plastic and physical magnitude and multiplicity of their representations of the Buddha. And everywhere in that vast world, where there are 150 million Buddhists, you will see the worshippers come into their temples and shrines quietly, with feet unshod, and clap their hands as if to attract the attention of the deity, bow their heads solemnly in silent prayer, and quietly and reverently, after dropping a small coin as an offering, leave the shrine. The spiritual message of Buddhism has greatly pervaded the life of these people and its great disciplines of morality and meditation and wisdom. Somehow you do not feel the same hankering after worldly position, worldly wealth, and economic advancement in that part of the world that you find elsewhere. There is an effort to stress the virtues of non-injury and non-violence and compassion and moderation. And everywhere you go in that world, you will see these saffron-clothed, saffron-robed monks. And in some of these countries, it's not a lifetime profession, but a man will go to a monastery and spend a few months or a year or two practicing the rigorous discipline of a monk, devoting his life to the period of his time that he's spending there, to meditation, to seclusion. In the morning you will see them with their beggar's bowls going around and receiving from the hands of the generous faithful ones food for the day. And some of the most powerful figures in that world, statesmen, professional people, will themselves put on the saffron robe and spend a month or two or three as monks, just for the sake of the spiritual discipline and for the refreshment of their souls. In Rangoon, Burma, we were able to see for the first time the shoals and the quicksands, the trials and the difficulties, which these new nations in the Far East have to encounter. We came to Rangoon at a very propitious time. The city, the capital, and the country were celebrating the 11th anniversary of its statehood. And it was decorated. There was much glitter and pomp and music and ceremony. The city was all bedecked. The streets of Rangoon, which are famous for their dirt and filth, had been cleaned up by the army, and it took the army some 2 months to clean them up. But everything was in order for the celebration. But we soon learned that this Republic of Burma, a country of some 20 million people, still nominally a democracy, was actually ruled by a dictator. Party strife and the struggle between the East and the West to take possession, as it were, of the and guidance of Burma had practically brought that government to a standstill. And so the head of the army, General Nguyen Win, stepped in and took over. We met the general at the palace garden party to which we were invited, but we also met the president of Burma. The president is only a figurehead. The ruler is this General Win. He has promised that there would be free elections in Burma sometime this coming spring. Of course, that remains to be seen. And what is true of Burma is largely true of nearly all the countries in the Far East. They have as yet no stability of government. And their difficulty in establishing themselves firmly is due in the main to the subterranean struggle between the East and the West for control between the communist and the non-communist countries of the world. In Burma, we met the first Israel ambassador, a charming and capable man, Dr. Daniel Levine, who has been doing a magnificent job in that country. Israel has also sent into Burma quite a number of experts to help the Burmese government, experts on irrigation, on agriculture, on health. And the Burmese government has welcomed these Israeli experts because they know they have no access to grind. They don't aim to drag the Burmese into any global alignments with one power bloc or another. As of the moment, there are some 40 or 50 Burmans, representatives of the government of Burma, in Israel, studying Israel's ways of doing certain things. In Bangkok, there is a Israeli ambassador, Dr. Kidron, and in Tokyo, Ambassador Najjar. The government of Israel is endeavoring to break the solid anti-Israeli front which was forged at Bandung a few years ago of the African Asian peoples. And I think slowly and effectively through helpful ways and constructive ways, it is succeeding in so doing. We visited small Jewish communities in large cities, in Manila, in Hong Kong, in Tokyo. In none of these cities is there a Jewish community of more than 500 souls. But they have their Jewish clubs, and with their Jewish clubs, their Jewish synagogues, and they're trying to maintain as active a Jewish life as they can. In Hong Kong, I may call your attention to this interesting thing. Hong Kong, as you know, is the emporium of the Far East and the delight of all women tourists and the despair of all men who accompany them. In Hong Kong, we met the famous Kaduri brothers. The Kaduris are an eminent and important family in the Far East. They were very generous in their attentions and in their entertainment. One of the two brothers, Horace Kaduri, is engaged in doing a remarkable piece of work in the new territory just outside of Hong Kong. As you know, there have been thousands of Chinese refugees who have in recent years poured into Hong Kong because of the Chinese Revolution. Penniless, without jobs, the charge on the colony of Hong Kong, and a potential center of communist agitation. Mr. Horace Kaduri felt that the way to check communism is to set up as many of these penniless Chinese as independent farmers. He acquired land and proceeded to advance interest-free loans to these Chinese to purchase cattle, poultry, feed, fertilizers, to build fish ponds, to engage in all types of land development. And he also built for them, out of his own funds, miles of roads. He built dams and bridges, wells and reservoirs, and orchards, built many homes for them, and also made cash grants. But largely his idea was not to pauperize them by giving them things, but by loaning them things to help them to help themselves. He also established a widow plan. The widow is the most unfortunate of all peoples in that part of the world. This fund has been assisting thousands of widows by giving them some cattle, a cow, some pigs, building for them some pigsties, lending them some money, interest-free, to purchase what they need, giving them, each of them, some 20, 30 chickens, and giving all of these people expert technical advice on breeding and management. With the result that in a few years, thousands of Chinese have been made independent small farmers, and hundreds of villages have been helped. And this is a one man's bloodless war against communism. I was tremendously fascinated as it took me to visit some of these farmers. And took me to his model farm, one of the most beautiful in the Far East, where the cattle is raised, which is then sold, given to these refugees. And perhaps this is the true way the only way in which we can be helpful to that part of the world. I read recently a book which you must have read called The Ugly American, and there's much criticism there of the American representatives in that part of the world who are carrying out our program of technical aid, economic aid, their incompetence, many of them lacking the ability to speak the language of the people whom they're trying to help, their arrogance, etc. I suppose that much of it is true, because otherwise there wouldn't be this wide-scale criticism of American aid in that part of the world. But I met quite a number of Americans, both connected with government and connected with other missions in all these countries which I visited. And I found many of them skilled, trained, competent, dedicated, who are trying to do a real service. Of course, we have tremendous competition in that part of the world, the Russians. People forget that Russia is a great Asiatic power, as well as a European power. Russia is closer to the scene. And Russia is far better trained in propaganda and in all the tricks of propaganda than we are, because that's how the movement first came into existence, as a result of propaganda. And it has thrived, not exclusively, but largely upon propaganda. We are still learning that art. Perhaps the greatest drawback, in my judgment, to our success in that part of the world is not the lack of dedication on the part of the men and the women we send there, but on our late realization that we ought not to tie up our assistance program with our political military objectives. And my thinking on the subject has been vindicated by thoughtful men who visited Asia, good Americans, enemies of communism, who brought back similar conclusions. Any advantage, writes Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, any advantage which Russia may enjoy over us in that part of the world will vary with current events. The revolt in Hungary was itself a hard blow to Russia. Russia's reaction to it, the way she managed it, and the reign of terror which she launched in that brave land sent Russia's prestige into a decline the world around. The message of Hungary reached understanding hearts and minds in Asia. Hungary helped the people of Asia know the true nature of the communist world and the terror it uses to fasten a regime on a people. Having just been colonial people, the Asians are opposed to any suppression or subjugation by a colonial power. The moral of Hungary is plain. It points to the one decisive advantage that we have over Russia in the contest for the minds and hearts of the uncommitted people of the world. That advantage is in the concept of liberty, freedom, and equality, which are deeply ingrained in our way of life. And these ideas of liberty, equality, and freedom constitute the one true advantage we have over the totalitarian world. They can bring us victory if we will only make them vital forces in our domestic affairs and translate them into affirmative terms when we come to foreign policy. But to make them positive influences in our foreign policy, we must first shift our emphasis from the military to the political, and second, go to Asia with humility, offering to help them solve their problem their own way. And if we can keep this guiding idea in mind, it seems to me that in this vast titanic contest in which the free world and the slave world is now engaged for the conquest of the minds of these uncommitted peoples of Asia, that in this contest the free world is bound to win, but only on the basis of true humanity, of true helpfulness, and with the technique of great humility. Well, I'm glad to be home again. I'm glad to get in contact with the movements moving in our great world here. Glad to be back to a land where there is freedom, where there is political stability, and a land which, in spite of all of its mistakes in foreign policy, perhaps in other fields, is still a great and blessed land and may become a beacon of light to all the undeveloped peoples of the world.